Yeah, so I would like to thank the organizers for having me here. So I'm going to talk about counting back all microstates as OpenString flux vector, which is sort of putting two kinds of work I've been doing together, in a sense. So the outline of my talk is as follows. So first I'll sketch the setting of the problem and precise formulation of what we're going to try to do. Then I'll get to the relation between black hole microstates and OpenString flux vector. And I'll end with the actual counting of the BPS states, which is what we want to do. All right, so the setting is type 2A, say type 2A string theory compactified on some Clavier manifold X. This gives in four dimensions n equals 2 supergravity theory coupled to some vector multiplets and some hypermultiplets, but the hypermultiplets decouple from everything we are going to say. So now in string theory, you can wrap various even brains, run various non-trivial cycles in the Clavier, and consider BPS bound states of those. This in four dimensions will manifest itself typically as some BPS black hole with electric and magnetic charges given by the wrapping numbers of these D brains. So that the six brain charge will be P naught, the four brain charge will be PA. So there's there can be many indices A, depending on how many four cycles are in the Clavier. The D2-brain charge dual to the four-brain charge is labeled by QA, and then finally the zero-brain charge is Q0. Okay. Now, the general problem one has considered in this context is to count the number of BPS states with a given charge P and Q, so we call that omega PQ, possibly counted with signs, and compare that with the gravity prediction. Right. Now, of course, Bekenstein and Hawking gave a formula predicting the degeneracy of such states, namely e to the area divided by 4 in four-dimensional Planck units. But our aim will be to go beyond that, and well beyond that. So there has been this conjecture by Uguri, Strominger, and Baffa that...
Is this counting with a plus sign or with minus one?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So that you from the supergravity point of, from the gravity point of view, what you say is you're really counting the total number of states. You're counting the full entropy. But so what one does in string theory is one counts these BPS states in some very weakly coupled regime, and then one uses supersymmetry to argue that if you increase the couplings but till you're in the gravity regime, that the number of states doesn't change. And actually, that is wrong. What actually does stay invariant is the index, so counted with signs. And so that is actually the only thing you really have control over. But it turns out that actually the index is what usually matches to the black hole entropy. So that's what we're going to compute. In some cases, actually, the index equals the total number of states also microscopically. So in those cases, you don't have any difficulty.
Not even really minus
100,
yeah. Well,
it's a, yeah, right. It's a helicity supertrace, so it's but yeah.
But in some cases, it doesn't matter.
Yes, so there are cases where you microscopically compute the number, absolute number of BPS states, and it actually doesn't quite match. But, you know, then you could say, well, okay, when you increase the coupling, actually these states pair up and disappear from the BPS spectrum. And so, yeah. All right. So, yeah. Okay, so what's Uguri, Strominger, and Baffa, OSV from now on, conjectured is that up to some somewhat unknown degree of approximation, at least, omega PQ, the degeneracy, is given as a Laplace transform of this particular function, where curly F depends on the magnetic charges P and on some electric potentials. Phi is defined in the following way. Is essentially the topological string free energy plus this complex conjugate, where this topological string free energy is given by this formula. I'll come back to that in a second. But where you make the following substitution. So G here originally is the string, topological string coupling constant. You replace that by this combination of P's and the phi's. And then the T's are the Kähler moduli in the original formulation, and you substitute this expression in there. All right, so what are these terms? Well, here, this is what, well, in the large Kähler limit just gives you the usual classical prepotential in the n equals 2 theory. This is a one loop correction, and these are a bunch of instanton corrections of genus H string world sheets wrapping curves in homology class beta. Right. So you get this complicated expression, substitute this all in, plug it in there, compute this integral, and that sort of magically should give you the number of PPS states with charge P and Q. So what's this motivation? What's the motivation for this kind of wild conjecture? Well, that is the observation made by Gouris, Sormage, and Vafa, that if you evaluate this integral in the leading order saddle point approximation, that you then reproduce the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and actually a little bit better than Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, the Bekenstein-Hawking-Wald entropy, which incorporates R squared correction. And so that is a straightforward exercise to show indeed that the leading saddle point approximation of this integral is given by other claimants. All right. Now, all right, so more concretely, we want to test this conjecture, of course. And so to do that, we need to find in some system, at least, this omega PQ beyond leading order. Right. So this is actually a very difficult problem in general. And there are a few cases known. So one is case of D4, D2, D0 bound states, which are dual to perturbative heterotic string states. These give rise to so-called small black holes. And in that case, of course, well, you know the exact degeneracies very well just from the perturbative heterotic string. So you can investigate those cases. Then people have considered also D4, D2, D0 bound states in a non-compact clavia. Vafa and these people have been focusing on that. You can get some way doing that, but then of course the black hole interpretation isn't very clear, right? When you have compactification on a manifold of infinite volume, the effective Newton constant is zero, and so what's really a black hole, and so on. So you get like conceptual issues that are not very clear. And finally, well, one case that people think they actually know all degeneracies, or at least have some formula, are T6 and K3 times T2, the formulas obtained by these people. And of course, in those cases, the problem is you have higher supersymmetry, and then the original OSV conjecture has been formulated for n equals 2 supersymmetry, so it's that there are some subtleties in reducing then the higher supersymmetry to the lower one. But anyway, so there's definitely some clear need for more general examples that are correspond to real big black holes, compact clavia, everything as it should be. And so in this talk, actually, I'm going to make a step in that direction. So we're going to consider arbitrary D4, D2, D0 bound states on an arbitrary compact clavier manifold. And, well, we won't be able to compute exact degeneracies for those cases for general charges, so the concession we're going to make is that we're going to work in the large D0 brain charge expansion. Right. And, well, then the funny twist in the story is that this will turn out to be computable using landscape techniques, or what you could call landscape techniques. So more precisely, techniques developed by Ashok and Douglas and myself and Douglas for counting flux vacua in type 2B string theory. Okay, so to get more concrete, so what's the specific problem we are now facing or have to show for the system we're going to consider? So there's a D4, D2, D0. Well, this function f, currently fp phi, for the D4, D2, D0 system, when you follow the substitution procedure that I gave you, looks like this, right? So the DABC, remember, were the triple intersection numbers of divisors. C2 is a second Chern class of the Calabi-Yau, and that's it, right? So the PAs are the magnetic charge of the forebrain. So this is the classical part, if you want, or the perturbative part, and then here there's a whole series of instanton corrections. Okay. Now, at the saddle point of this OSV integral, one finds that roughly phi naught goes like this, and phi a goes like that. So you see, when q naught becomes very large, phi naught becomes very small, phi a becomes very small. And as a result, in particular, since phi naught becomes very small, the instanton corrections become strongly suppressed. Even, you know, with this diverging, this whole thing still goes to zero. Now, okay, I'm a little bit quick here. So there are actually also instanton contributions at beta equals zero, at the degenerate instanton contributions. They are not exponentially suppressed in this limit, but so you can resum them, and actually they give a zeta of 3 times phi naught square contribution to this. But you see, when phi naught goes to zero, also that contribution becomes vanishingly small. Good. So sorry. Yeah.
The beta equals zero, the exponential contribution.
Yeah. But there is a zeta of 3 phi naught square term in the. Oh, okay. You say because we continue to. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. Of course. That's the reason. Yeah. Okay. Well, then it's even better. So then we don't even have to consider this at all, and this is really what we have to test. That's right. Yeah, I was wondering why I didn't. Good. So, okay, what do we need to do? The most efficient way, the most economical way of testing the whole thing is to compute the inverse thing, namely the partition function, so summing over all electric charges, omega pq times e to the pi phi q. And then we have to show that at small phi naught, right, which becomes a large q naught, that this reduces to e to the curly f naught, where curly f naught is f without the instanton corrections. That's what we need to show. Okay, so how are we going to do this? Well, so let's have a look at a concrete microscopic model of this system. So we look at a D4 brain wrapped on some divisor P, expanded in this way in basis elements, with n D0 brains bound to it and some U1 flux F turned on. Right, some big smooth divisor. Here's the picture. So the total D0 brain charge then is given by, of course, well, number of D0 brains, and then this is flux-induced D0 brain charge, and then this here is curvature-induced D0 brain charge. So chi is the Euler characteristic of P, is given by the triple self-intersection number of the divisor plus second Chern class of the Calabi-Yau evaluated on P. Okay. The two brain charges are somewhat simpler and just simply given by the basis elements here dotted with F, and the dot product here is just the intersection product on H2 of P, so it's just integral of of this combination over P. All right. Now, the crucial observation is that typically the dimension of this of the second cohomology of the divisor is actually much, much bigger than the dimension of the second cohomology of X. So there is a huge degeneracy in this formula. There's many different fluxes, F, that actually give rise to exactly the same charges. So that means if you want to count the total number of VPS states, you have to take into account that additional degeneracy as well, and that hadn't been done before. So you really need to count different flux realizations for a given charge. And so that will be the challenge we face. Okay. Now, of course, we are encountering supersymmetric configurations because it's actually easy to see that, you know, if you just sum over all fluxes and you don't care about supersymmetry, you get an infinite number of such realizations, which is obviously not what we want. But of course, we restrict to supersymmetric configurations, and this requires that the 0-2 part of F is 0. So F should be a 1-1 form. Now, for generic fluxes on the D4 brain, at generic points in the deformation moduli space of the D4 brain, this will not be satisfied. Okay. So there's one exception, namely fluxes that are pulled back from the ambient Calabi-Yau. Those are automatically of type 1-1, and so, of course, for those, the supersymmetry conditions are satisfied identically. But the bulk, I mean, especially for, you know, P large, for large divisors, the bulk of the flux is actually is not pulled back from H2 of X. And in that case, the condition F02 equals 0 imposes H20 equations on H20 geometric moduli of P. So I'll remind you in a second why there are exactly H20 geometric moduli of P. But so you see, generically, that this then will restrict the moduli, the deformation moduli of this divisor, to a set of isolated points. And so this is very similar to what you get, you have studied in the case of closed strings. So you get isolated vacua where the moduli are fixed by the fluxes, and so therefore one could call these open string flux vacua. Okay, so let me remind you, facts about the divisor moduli space. So there are deformations, say, parametrized by coordinates zi, which correspond to holomorphic deformation of this surface. So, and then the important thing is that there is actually a 1-1 correspondence between infinitesimal holomorphic deformations of P given by holomorphic normal vector fields, delta n, and H20 of P. So these equivalents goes as follows. So you just vary the moduli. You see what the holomorphic vector field is that corresponds to that variation. You dot that vector field with a 3-0 form of the Calabi-Yau. That gives you a 2-0 form living on the surface. And, you can show that this is a one-to-one map. So indeed, the number of moduli is H20 of P, as I claimed before. Okay, now, the crucial geometric structure that will allow us to do, you know, this computation is what has been called N equals 1 special geometry by Röckemeyer and Warner, living on this moduli space. And so what is that? Well, or at least how is it manifested in this particular case? Well, so consider this divisor P that now, it's actually four-dimensional, but let's imagine it two-dimensional. So we choose a basis, I mean, at least for this picture, right? We choose a basis, C alpha of H2 of P, of two cycles of P. And we also choose corresponding tree chains, gamma alpha, that are such that the boundary of the tree chain is C alpha, and possibly also, you know, gamma alpha also may have other fixed z-independent boundary components, right? So you might be forced to do that. Z are the deformation moduli of the divisor, right? So you get this chain, it ends on one end of the divisor, and so the point is that the z-dependent part of the chains is given by the C alpha, if you want. Okay, so now you define chain periods. At least, you know, all this is locally in the moduli space, right? In this way, so it's just the integral of the holomorphic tree form of the Calabi-Yau over these tree chains. And note then that derivatives of these chain periods with respect to the divisor deformation moduli are given us by the following. So it's just the derivative of a change of gamma alpha with these moduli that is easily seen to be the same as the integral over this boundary times the over this boundary of the corresponding deformation vector field dotted with omega, and as I just showed, that is nothing but omega I to zero, so one of these basis elements of the two zero forms integrated over C alpha.
How do we know that the form C alpha, or well, that there must exist gamma alpha such that
Well, no. So there don't necessarily exist a gamma alpha such that the boundary of gamma alpha is C alpha. So there may be other boundary components to gamma alpha, but you can choose those not to depend on the divisor, and then they will drop out if you compute a variation. They will drop out. So you see there's a big ambiguity in these periods, but then if you compute a derivative, the ambiguity is significantly reduced. It depends now only on this C alpha. And so every physical quantity would actually be expressed in terms of derivatives of pi. Okay, so now, there's a natural Kähler metric on this moduli space, which is determined by the periods. So the natural Kähler metric is the, the Hodge metric. So if you have this set of basis elements that we defined, it's just the wedge product of omega i with bar like a j, which can be written in this way as I just showed, and that in turn can be written in this way. So you see this metric indeed is derived from a Kähler potential given in this way. Q alpha beta is the intersection product on H2 of B, and indices up means I've inverted it. Okay. And now, what's going to be crucial for us is the following. So we showed that the derivative of pi is the period factor of a 2-0 form. And now by Griffith's transversality, you get that the covariant derivative with respect to this metric of this derivative is actually going to be a 1-1 form. And this, by orthogonality of 2-0 and 1-1 forms on a surface, implies equalities like this. So the dd pi intersected with d pi actually gives you 0. Right? And so it's identities like this that give this geometric structure the name n equals 1 special geometry, because all these things are very reminiscent of the standard n equals 2 special geometry you have for closed string moduli. Okay, so keep this in mind. It will come in handy. All right. Now, the supersymmetry conditions can actually be nicely given in terms of a superpotential. So, given the flux F, let's consider the Poincaré dual two cycle sigma F on P. And now, say expand sigma f in this basis C alpha that we had earlier. So get this M alpha. And define now a superpotential W of f simply by the corresponding linear combination of these chain periods. Well, then you see that the derivative of W with respect to the moduli is given by this expression, following the reasoning we had earlier, which by construction is nothing but the integral over p of f wedge omega I. So that means that f02 equals 0, the Suzy condition, if and only if, get a product with all two zero forms of f vanishes, and so even only if the derivative of w equals zero, right? So we have, translated the supersymmetry condition into superpotential condition. So now you say, well, now everything looks very, very similar to the case, you know, we encountered in investigating the landscape of closed string vacuum. And so let me remind you what the closed string landscape of flux vacuum looks like. So looks like this. And so now we find that the open string landscape looks like that. So that's very good. So they have the same form, and therefore the same techniques are applicable.
Is WF the superpotential over some physical theory, or is it a mathematical
concept? Well, I mean, it's the physics of the D4 brain, right? So it's a physical theory.
It's a superpotential in the lower
energy. But one thing, one thing maybe I didn't mention is, so you see these conditions there, it's like an ordinary derivative equals zero. So you see there's no covariant derivative, there's no Kähler potential here. And so the reason is that indeed the physics of the four brains, right, is described, I mean, at very big string coupling, at least just by the Born-Infeld action. And that Born-Infeld action, of course, has just rigid supersymmetry, right? Global supersymmetry. There's no local supersymmetry. There's no supergravity living on these brains. So that's indeed why the structure you find is that of global supersymmetry, which actually will make the analysis easier than in the closed string case. Yeah.
So you said that these fluxes haven't been included in previous counting.
That's right.
But yet they got the right answer.
That's right, because the leading part is independent of those things.
This
will affect the sub-leading part, and of course now that's the new thing with the OSV contexture. That's what we now need to test, so that's why people got away with it. All right. So let's get to the part. Let's get to business. Okay, so how do you count critical points? So at a fixed flux F, the number of isolated critical points of WF is given by this expression. So what is this? Well, you just integrate over the moduli space. This delta function will pick out critical points, and then this determinant of the second derivative is there just to guarantee that this delta function contributes with plus one for each zero. So it's Jacobian, if you want. Yeah. Okay. So at any such critical point, the divisor is frozen, right? So the only remaining moduli are the positions of the nd0 brains on this d4 brain. So quantizing that component, then, you find that the number of BPS states contributed by this is, as usual, it's given by, supersymmetric states are, ground states are in one-to-one correspondence with the cohomology of this moduli space. And so that means in this case that number of BPS states, or the index actually, will be given by the Euler characteristic of the Hilbert scheme of n points on this divisor. Right? And, well, this is well known, so it's given by p chi of n, where p chi of n are given by this generating function. So adding all this up gives you 1 over the eta function, Dedekind eta function, to the power chi. Okay? So this is straightforward. So that's the contribution of each of these to the total entropy of each of these flux vacua.
So by the Hilbert scheme, do you mean the symmetric product?
Yeah, symmetric product.
So
right.
Not the resolution.
Right. Well, you know, it's either the string Euler characteristic of the symmetric products of endpoints, or the ordinary cohomology of the Hilbert scheme.
So
it's the same thing.
The Euler characteristic is given by the orbifold.
The orbifold. Exactly. Okay. Good. So let's compute this partition function. So we sum over all D2 and D0 brain charges, omega PQ times this thing. So that's the same as we just argued as summing over all fluxes. counting the number of critical points corresponding to that flux. And then, of course, we also sum over the number of these zero brains that we add to the mix. And so the degeneracy of each component is given by this expression. And then here, I substituted the expression for Q0 I wrote down earlier and the expression for QA I wrote down earlier. So, well, there's one thing I have to mention, and that is that, of course, in general, actually, generically, some, you know, flux will freeze all moduli, but there may be some fluxes that actually do not freeze all moduli, right? And so they will give different contributions to this. But since we are actually going to work in the small phi naught limit or in the large Q naught limit, that will correspond to having a very large flux sphere to sum over, and so the number of fluxes for which it, you know, it will not be everything will not be frozen, will be negligible compared to the others. So that's fine at the level that we are working. Good. So now the sum over n, well, factors are trivially. So you see, you know, pi chi n e to the pi phi naught n. Interestingly, the minus chi over 24 here is exactly also what we need to get exactly the eta function here. So this was this curvature-induced zero brain charge. So that just gives this factor. And we're left with this. So now I, you know, reintroduce this expansion of f in terms of the basis C alpha, substitute all this. Now, okay, this looks still like something that's pretty hard to evaluate. But now the trick is, you know, I mean, to rewrite these guys, the delta function is determinant in terms of integrals of exponentials. So the delta function can be written as integral over lambda of this expression, and the determinant can be written as some fermionic integral of this expression. Yeah. And so you see that this just adds terms to the exponential we had before that are just linear in M, right? So you see the sum over M actually is Gaussian. So you get a Gaussian ensemble, if you want, with boson, fermion, fermion interactions given here. But that will allow us to make progress. Now, at this point, we're going to make the approximation, a large Q0 approximation. So that will, that implies that there are large fluxes allowed. So why do I say large fluxes correspond to large Q0? Well, remember, there's this F squared term that will contribute to the zero brain charge. And if you have large zero brain charge, the F squared, which is sort of M squared, can become very large. And so, indeed, the M alpha will be very large. And so, in that case, you can make a continuum approximation, right? So the idea is same as counting a number of lattice points inside a huge sphere. Well, you can do that by just computing the volume of the sphere. So in other words, by just replacing the sum over M by an integral over M. And the integral over M, so just argued, is then just a straightforward Gaussian. And so you get this thing. So these are the Lagrange multipliers we introduced. this comes from doing the Gaussian integral. So B. So since, yeah, so this is an important point as well, since the intersection form is unimodular, there's a factor determinant of this intersection form that appears, but it is one, right? And so the only thing that comes from the Gaussian is this factor. Yeah. Squared.
In your formula,
right.
Absolute value of from the very beginning.
Also yeah. That's right. So you get, yeah. So this is, since you have to, this delta function is, you know, di w equals 0 and di bar w bar equals 0. So there's the I and the I bar variables, and right? The z and z bar variables. And so this determinant also has to go over the z and z bar variables. So you actually get 2n times 2n determinant, right, of which the upper left block is d squared w and the lower right block is the complex conjugate of that. And then off diagonal, unlike the local, the supergravity case, the closed string case, has nothing. And so the total determinant just is the modulus squared of, which is, so this is actually, again, a simplification compared to the closed string case. There's no, we don't have to make any index approximation. Okay. And, all right, so then the exponent you get from doing the Gaussian is this horrible looking expression. So, well, this is twice the same, so don't get too intimidated. But so it's basically the scalar product of this expression with itself. So at first sight, well, it looks, you know, these are five terms. It looks like you get 25 complicated cross terms in the exponential that, you know, like don't look particularly friendly at all. So you think, well, I might as well give up. But recall, so now this is where this special geometry structure comes in. Recall that the derivative of pi is 2-0 form. The second derivative is 1-1, and phi is also 1-1 form, right? So because it's what comes back from the ambient Clavijau. And then since only products of 1-1 with 1-1 and 2-0 with 0-2 can be non-zero, it means that most of the cross terms are actually zero. Yeah. And so the only non-trivial intersection products contributing are this guy, d pi with d bar pi, which is just a metric if you work it out, and then this intersection, which is nothing but the curvature if you work it out. Okay, so this whole exponential collapses simply to this expression, and now you're basically finished. So you can do the Gaussian integral over lambda that gives this stuff, over psi gives this thing. Now you integrate this over theta and combine it with a measure of integration over z. This produces this measure, where r is a curvature form on the moduli space. Okay, so you first integrate over the size, right? And so you keep the thetas, right? So that gives you this thing.
Okay.
And now, right, and so now you integrate over the thetas and then it just gives you this curvature. Okay. So then we basically have our final result. Well, remember there was also this e to the chi prefactor. We do a modular transformation on that one as well, because we want this 1 over phi naughts appearing. So that's easy. so here, chi, again, is the early characteristic of the d4 brain. So this is given by b2 minus 2 plus 2. Okay. Putting everything together, we get this expression. And now, well, since we're working the phi naught limit, can also just approximate this 1 over eta to the chi by its leading term, which is this. Oops. Okay. And so here this chi hat of m is, well, what you could call the Euler characteristic, but I put it, it's not quite the Euler characteristic, as I will shortly discuss. So it's given by this integral of the determinant of the curvature form over the moduli space, which, if the metric were regular, this would be exactly the Euler characteristic, but the metric has singularities, so this is not so clear. Okay.
So what is the leading dependence on charges?
The leading dependence on charges of what, of z, or?
No, of zero before
the leading dependence on, what, of the entropy, you mean?
Well, I mean this chi.
The chi hat depends only on the magnetic charges, only on the, because it's a property of the divisor moduli space, which depends only on the divisor class. So, but I'll yeah. So. Well, I'll get to some examples. So the problem is in general, people, as far as I know, don't know how to compute this. My guess is that it actually goes as p cubed. That's why it's right.
Yeah, this was essentially the hardest part of your computation.
That's right. So this is the, yeah.
The rest which you'll probably explore is the fastest parameter function. So that's.
Yeah, that's right. But then, okay. Yeah, that's correct. So this is the non. Yeah. Well, I'll get to that in a bit. All right. 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 Yeah. So R is. Yeah. Well, but okay. Well, so, I mean, okay, evaluating this guy hat, if you want, you know, with respect to this Hodge metric is an interesting mathematical problem in itself. And so we will be able to do some predictions for guy hat. So that's, so let me, right. So the comparison with OSV is very simple now. So you see this was sort of prediction, we find that z equals this chi hat of m times this finite dependent prefactor. So b1 is the b1 of the Calabi-Yau, right? So for most, this is just 0, but for t6 and t2 times k3, this is somewhat different. And so, well, indeed, essentially, this confirms the conjecture in this regime up to this prefactor refinement. So now, I mean, this may not seem too impressive, indeed, because, you know, in the end, the whole computation basically collapsed to this, you know, prefactor and this simple phi naught. But this is not, you know, well, it wasn't a priori obvious that it would indeed simplify in this way. But, well, the nevertheless, so I to remind you that this simple-looking partition function in some encodes an infinite series of 1 over n corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula. So it's not a trivial thing on itself. Now, okay, so let me get to the chi hat factor. So, yeah. So Qi and Yin actually looked at the case that I mentioned earlier, x equals t6 and x equals t2 times k3. And so they started from, you know, completely independent formulas for the microscopic degeneracies. And so they, you know, obtained a certain result. Now, if you take that result and look at the limit phi naught to 0, it should coincide with our result. And so that is only the case if chi hat of p for t6 equals 1 over p cubed, where p cubed is, well, there p cubed is, you know, our triple intersection divided by 6. So in other words, if p, in the special case that you take t6 to be t2 times t2 times t2, and you take a divisor to be given, you know, by the usual diagonal ones, labeled by charges pi, then you get that chi hat is predicted, if you want, to be 1 over pi 1 times pi p2 times p3. For t2 times k3, similarly, if you compare their formula to ours, there you get that chi hat has to be equal to p of k3 squared plus 4 divided by 2 p of t2. Now, so since their derivation is completely independent, if you want, this gives a prediction, mathematical prediction, for this chi hat or the characteristic. Now you see, well, these things are non-integral, right? So you might at first sight say, well, this is completely crazy, you know, the characteristics should be integral. But it's, of course, not crazy because chi hat, indeed, does not need to be integral because M has singularities, a modulized space of singularities. So there's a similar thing actually happening for closed strings. The only case where I know how to compute this thing exactly is namely for the mirror quintic moduli space, and there you find that this chi hat is actually 1/5 of the analog thing. Okay. But so because of this thing. What's your. No. So this is just in the. So if you look at. It's completely different, but it's an analogous thing. So if you look at the closed string case where you have. Right, it's an analogous thing. So you look at the mirror quintic moduli space, which is one dimensional. You define the Weyl-Peterson metric, which is sort of the analogon of this thing. and you compute its curvature and you compute the integral, you find 1/5. Yeah, that may be. I don't know. I haven't thought about that yet. But, yeah. Okay, so. That's right, because the 5 is, of course, a 5 of quintic, right? So in the quintic, you can actually, well, so for the quintic, we did it at the time with Mike first, numerically, you know, and it was like this humongous program. It took a long time to write. It ran for 24 hours because you have to patch the modulized space and little things, and, you know, it's very hard numerical computation. And so, I computed 5 times this integral of the curvature. And so then that should be pi, right? Because there's 1/π factor here. And so, you know, I ran the computation for 24 hours, added everything up, and indeed I got like 3.1415, which I absolutely didn't expect. So it was like, okay, it's like probably the world's most inefficient way to compute pi. But so that actually we figured out, well, you can do it analytically, and then you get this result. But so in this case, I don't know how to do it analytically. And okay. So are these values plausible? Is that the question? Yeah. And I'm going to argue that indeed they are. So okay, let's look at the case T6. So the relevant moduli space is deformations of the divisor modulo T6 translation. So that's, you know, you have to do, it's related to the fact that you have higher supersymmetry. You have to factor out this thing because translations, you know, never get frozen by flux. And the trivial T6 factor you otherwise have will just give chi hat equals 0. So you clearly don't want that. So you just factor out this trivial part. And so what you would need to compute then is the Euler characteristics of this quotient moduli space. Now, a divisor in a class T given by this P1, P2, P3, as before, can be described as a zero locus of a linear combination of theta functions. Well, and so, what are some generalized theta functions? So here, these theta mu p's are given by these products, and each of these guys individually is given by this theta function with, how do you call these, with characteristics or something, with something?
Level k
theta functions. Okay, so you just sum over k equals mu mod mod p, and so all right. That gives you a convenient representation of arbitrary divisors. So the naive moduli space is just the space of all these coefficients mod c star over all this scaling, obviously, which is this cp1 p2 p3 minus 1. But there is a residual translation symmetry group that, you know, we agree to mod out, and so that you just obtain by shifting the zi's by the torsion points on the torus. So if you do that, you see that just acts by permutations and phase shifts of the a mu's, right? So it just is symmetry group, the remnant of our translation symmetry group, acting on this cp1 p2 p3 minus 1 moduli space. So the true moduli space is the quotient of this projective space by this order p1, p2, p3 squared discrete group. Okay. And so if we make the very reasonable assumption, even though it's probably very non-trivial to prove it, that chi hat of this covering space is just the ordinary Euler characteristic of the covering space, then you get for chi hats of the actual moduli space, well, this product divided by its square, so 1 over p1, p2, p3. No, well, CP is, but the thing is, so you have to see what the metric is on this covering space. The metric on this covering space is still given by this Hodge metric, right? And so it has still singularities, and you know, there's various kinds of degenerations that can occur. A priori, it looks like a very wild thing, but then the prediction would be that these singularities don't matter. I don't know if all the singularities are just orbifold singularities. I don't think so. I mean, at least in the closed string case, definitely not all the singularities are orbifold singularities, but this case. Well, I don't know. Yeah, it may be that this is indeed it would be nice if that was if it was as simple as that. Yeah. If they're only people have actually there are some mathematicians now working on the Clavijau case, on the closed string case, and then you know there are arguments saying that you can actually indeed neglect the discriminant locus, and you know it's sort of complicated. I don't know if maybe it's simpler here. I don't know. It's not simple there. It's not trivial there. It would be useful. Okay, so this is exactly what we needed. Similarly, for T2 times K3, now we only have a residual translation symmetry for the T2 factor, right? So that, you know, by the same reasoning gives us projective space that parametrizes divisors in T2 times K3, if you don't think about translation subtleties, is has dimension given by this triple intersection divided by 6 plus C2 dot B over 12 minus 1. So that, you know, assuming you get the projective space of this dimension, that would be its Euler characteristic. And now there is still this discrete residual symmetry group you mod out by, but it's now only in one T2 factor. So you get only 1 over P squared T2. And computing everything in this case gives you this factor, which is exactly, again, as was required to match to the shape. So if you want, maybe, you know, I could make a conjecture that, you know, typically, you know, if you have a divisor described by some hypersurface in like, say, the quintic or something, then very naturally the moduli space will be some projective space. So if you look at that space and forget about possible identifications you have to make, and you want to compute the chi hat of that covering space, then the conjecture would be that it would be just equal to the normal, to the ordinary Euler characteristic. Okay, and so the final slide then. I applied these techniques originally developed for counting vacua to this black hole case. You can also now, you know, let the information flow in the other way and just apply these results to counting D7, D3 flux vacuum, right? So the idea is now, instead of localized brains in space, you make the brain space filling so that D0 becomes a D3, D4 becomes a D7, and so make sure that the set ball cancellation conditions are satisfied and so on. And you can, you know, consider this counting problem that we just considered, just subproblem of counting vacua of type 2B oriented for compactifications, namely the open string sector of it, the Lebrun sector of it.
I would think the tangent problem would be very, very non-trivial because these black holes have flux, which is going. So, I mean, don't they all have tangent holes?
Yeah. So, in this case, you would have the D0 brain, the total D0 brain charge, if you want, would be fixed. So there's one. This type 2B tadpole is a D3 brain tadpole, which in the black hole case would be D0 brain. So.
Right.
So large Q0 would require large D3 tadpole, and it's not always. It's actually typically not easily satisfied. So you can only take these continuum results then as some hint of what the right answer is. But in principle, at least in suitable cases, it can be done. Okay. Now there's another set of related subtleties, namely in oriented folds, the divisor will be constrained to be compatible with the involution, so you cannot make it deform it as much as you can in n equals 2 case. And the flux F on the divisor must be odd. But those two things probably fit nicely together Well, I didn't work out the details, but I think that can be easily taken care of with a slight modification. Okay. Now, of course, in this case, you can do better in a way. So this counting would only be valid at very weak string coupling, zero string coupling, right? Because we use this globally supersymmetric D-brain picture and so on. You can actually do better and count all open and closed flux vacua at arbitrary coupling, namely by looking at F theory on a fourfold. Yeah. And so indeed, you can also nicely see that the open string sector of that reduces essentially to the kind of stuff we've been doing, at least at weak string coupling. But so if you want OSV, count a subsector of these vacua, but counting components weighted by their order characteristic.
Yeah, in the KPLT vector, there are D3 brain instantons which are important. Are these also?
So these are ignored. You assume sort of that sector, the Kähler sector, to be stabilized, not contributing too much to the total degeneracy, and that's the usual caveat. Yeah. So that indeed is a big assumption that is sort of a question mark. Yeah. Anyway, so what's the main conclusion then of this talk, if you want? Well, working on black holes and a topological string is working on landscape statistics. There's no escape. Yeah, that's right. And so, but then, yeah, and so, well, dropping all the parts of the moduli space where you have residual moduli, where you don't freeze all the moduli, but that sort of, well, so once you go to the integral representation, you have a continuum of fluxes, then the set of fluxes where not all the moduli are going to be frozen will be some set of measure zero. And so, so you could say that's indeed the only approximation. Yeah. In principle, yeah. So you can actually, yeah, instead of doing this integral, this continuum approximation, you can do a Poisson resummation. But then the problem is, so the leading term is the same thing, and the subleading terms are very messy, and we haven't really been able yet to extract much useful from it. So, yeah.
I was just wondering if your collaborators shared it.
Yeah. Well, you have to ask my collaborator. No, I know. No, his answer would be, well, you know, it's not because, you know, you're counting something. It's not there or something.
Have you thought
about including
the 6
line? Briefly, but then I got a headache and I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. No, so not in any detail, no.
Thanks for that.